there are different ways of talking about and exploring the personality. Obviously, the most well-known and current and popular is to do so psychologically. And certainly there has been a great deal of research and exploration and writing and thought about the nature of the personality ever since Freud began exploring and experimenting back in the latter part of the 19th century. But this is not my background. I am not trained in any way as a psychologist. Another way to look at the personality is from a neurobiological point of view. And while I do have some training in biology that now would be vastly outdated because it's over 40 years ago, I'm also not a neurobiologist, though I enjoy keeping up with what's happening, but strictly now as a layperson. But nevertheless, I'm aware that there are ways of describing the personality strictly in terms of biochemistry and brain chemistry and body chemistry and so on. And the neurobiological field and the psychological field are increasingly overlapping. But my particular experience comes out of a different domain. It comes out of, I guess you would say, clairvoyant research or observation and communication with non-physical beings. And from that point of view, the personality is an energy reality, an energy structure, a structure of subtle energy. And it's that perspective that I can offer today, and that will be the basis of our exploration. As most of you know, the work that I've been doing for the past, well, really since the 60s, but more formally since the turn of the century, has been in what I call incarnational spirituality. And initially this work began because a non-physical being who became my friend and colleague and mentor, whom I named John, said that he and his colleagues were engaged in a project, kind of a research project in a way, where the essential question was, is it possible to heighten an individual's experience of themselves as a spiritual being by focusing on the incarnate self, on the personality and the everyday person, as compared to focusing on transpersonal or transcendent reality? So from the very beginning of my association with John, he said, our work together is to look at how these different aspects of the individual, usually called soul and personality, can come together and collaborate. In what way are they part of a whole system and not two opposing forces? At that time in my life, I was part of a kind of metaphysical culture made up of a number of groups and individuals in Phoenix and in Los Angeles. And in that culture, the personality was without question perceived as foe. There was just no question that it was foe. And the objective of spiritual work was to overcome it or transmute it or in some way prevent it from getting in the way of what the soul wished to do. So there was this very clear dichotomy that was part of the thinking in that particular culture at that time. And it was that sort of framed this context, it created the context in which John said our work is to look beyond that, to not just accept that as the reality, but to see more deeply what's really going on. But it wasn't really until the turn of the century, around 2001, 2002, that a much more concerted effort, I guess I'd say, on the part of my own inner colleagues began to focus on this issue of incarnation and the nature of the personality as part of that. And for reasons that are too lengthy to get into here, but it seemed like just the timing was right to start doing that. And by then, by that time in my life, John had long gone. He had left around 1990 to go do other things. And but yet the colleagues that his colleagues that I had been in touch with, for whom he had been a kind of spokesperson, that relationship remained and is pretty much the group that I continue to work with. So so the idea of the personality then became a topic for exploration within this larger context of incarnation and the incarnational process. And it's that that approach that I'll be using today, as I said. So where I would like to begin is to say something about what the nature of this world is. To understand the nature of the personality in the way that I see it and experience it, we need to understand the nature of this world. And of course, we look around and we see, obviously, physical matter, and we're part of that physical matter, and we take this world for granted, and it has characteristics that we grow up with, and they are inherent in our nature. And for us, the non-physical world is the strange place, assuming that we even believe in it. And of course, many people in our culture do not. So we have a materialist perspective that says only that which is made of matter is real, and therefore this is the only real place in creation. But what is the nature of matter as seen from the, let's say, from the soul's perspective? What is it about this place that makes it useful? Why even create a realm like this? Why have a realm like this when there are so many other possibilities in the way that life and consciousness can manifest? So one of the characteristics that this realm offers, which is actually very valuable and somewhat rare on the inner worlds, is a quality of resistance. And it's a quality that we often run up against and don't particularly appreciate it, particularly when people resist us. But we want to think of resistance now in a deeper way as a kind of friction, as something that slows something down. So one metaphor for this is to imagine walking across a frozen lake. And if you're on ice skates, it's not much of a problem. The skates, you know, cut into the ice and you get traction. But if you're walking normally with ordinary shoes, you know, you slip and slide and you have to be very careful because the ice is comparatively a frictionless surface. So if you, in fact, push yourself off in a lake and you're sliding, you can slide quite a distance before what friction does exist slows you down and brings you to a stop. But if you tried that on the pavement out here, you wouldn't go anywhere. So one of the characteristics of the subtle worlds is its fluidity. And the rapidity with which it can change. We could say that it's a very protean domain, highly malleable by thought and feeling. So let's say that we're sitting here in the subtle worlds and we want to have coffee together. And we're having a wonderful time visiting, but we need to have coffee cups, and so we think of coffee cups, and the coffee cups materialize, and here they are, and we've got our coffee in them, and then we get so caught up in the conversation, and our mind wander, and now we're not thinking of coffee cups, and lo and behold, the coffee cups disappear. And the coffee is spilled onto the floor, or maybe the coffee itself disappears. This is an extreme example. It's not quite that fluid, but yet this is an issue that things exist and are accessible and useful only so long as some consciousness is actually thinking of them. Now, the way it's actually structured is that there are consciousnesses who have the capacity to maintain the necessary thoughts for very, very long periods of time, hundreds or thousands of years by our standards, so that those who do not have that capacity have a relatively stable environment in which to experience life. But still, things are fundamentally fluid. Enter resistance, resistance to change, resistance to this fluidity, a kind of movement towards solidity. And here in the physical realm, that coffee cup is going to stay on that table forever, unless one of us moves it someplace else, or ultimately, depending on what it's made of, it begins to decay and fall apart. But, you know, modern plastics, they'll stay around for millennia. And that's really resistance. So here is an opportunity for the soul, for non-physical consciousness, to experience a realm in which things change very slowly by comparison to the inner worlds. And that has a lot of advantages because it means that you can hold on to an experience and hold on to a particular condition and not actually have to keep thinking about keeping it in existence. You can begin to now experience it in other ways, in new ways. For example, I don't have to think about keeping this coffee cup or teacup in existence, and so now I can begin exploring different brands of coffee, you see, or different kinds of tea. I can use this container to do things with, and it will just stay here for me. I don't have to think about that, and I can change things in and out. This is wonderfully convenient. Now I'm obviously exaggerating here a bit, just to make a point, because nothing is quite as extreme, or generally is not, as I've been portraying it, but I want to emphasize that this quality of resistance to change is a fundamental quality of the incarnate realm, what I call the incarnate realm, or the physical, and of which the physical realm is part. So there are other fundamental qualities as well, but this is the one that I want to particularly focus on today. The other quality is, I suppose I would say it's related to it. It's, in a way, it's the simplicity of this realm compared to the inner worlds. And one of the challenges of working with many subtle beings that I've had over the years is that they really are multidimensional. That it's, so it's like walking into this house and something is going on in every room of the house. And you're aware that the people you want to meet, let's say Jeremy and Freya here, it would be as if Jeremy and Freya are spread throughout all the rooms of this house. And we could just say physically they're constantly moving downstairs, upstairs, into the basement, around. And so to carry on a conversation with them, I have to, you know, you would have to move around as well. And it means you have to embrace the wholeness of the house. In some ways, it's more convenient if Jeremy and Freya would just stay put here in the living room. And all we had to deal with was just this room, and we don't have to worry about what's going on in the other rooms. It helps to concentrate and focus our activity. So the incarnate realm, particularly the physical realm, is bounded by the three dimensions of space, the fourth dimension of time, definitely bounded by the structure of our brain and the way that we perceive and experience time and experience space. And while at one hand it's a limitation, because now we're having to deal with what's in just one room, and we can certainly go into the other rooms, but it's no longer as easy to do so. And for many people, the other rooms simply don't exist. But for a soul that may want to focus on and have the experience of a singular conversation, let's say, having it contained in one room is an advantage. Now again, I'm using a very physical metaphor to try to explain a non-physical reality, so we have to take it with a couple of grains of salt. But the main point is that what's often thought of as the limitations or the restrictions of the physical realm are not viewed as such by the soul, because they are seen as having a purpose, something that advances the soul's interest and intent. It's only when we get here and we are kicking against the traces, so to speak, because we remember, some part of us remembers, and not just remembers, some part of us exist. I mean, there are parts of us, the subtle parts of us, that exist spread throughout the rest of the house, and sometimes we get antsy recognizing there are these other rooms, and shouldn't I be filling up the house? And what am I doing confined to this, just the living room? So there are these challenges involved, but nevertheless, the value of this contained space, something with boundaries, within which something else can develop and be heightened, is very important. So we've got boundaries and we have resistance. And those are two characteristics of the physical realm that do not exist in the same way or with the same intensity in most of the subtle realms, I should say. And one of the consequences of these two principles is that things on this level tend to be particularized. So that coffee cup is different from the other two coffee cups next to it on the table, and they're both different from the coffee holder from that's made out of cardboard or whatever it's made out of. We can look at them and we visually tell them apart, and we see they're located in different places on the table. In one way, they all embody the concept of coffee cups, so that we could say at one level they're kind of smeared together as a unity. But here we experience them in this particularity. We experience each other as particular people. This gives meaning to the fact that I can call myself David, and Julie can call herself Julie, and Jeremy can call himself Jeremy, and Karen, and so on. And yet, there are levels in which our identities, while not dissolving per se, nevertheless, the boundaries are more permeable, and we experience each other in more direct fashion in an exchange of our presence. But that's not, I mean, that can certainly happen for us here in the physical form, but it's not the way we experience our physical identities. We are bounded in our physical bodies, and they have certain characteristics, and we are bounded in space and time. I'm right here in this room in Everett at 10:45 in the morning on Saturday. I'm not smeared through all time and all space. Some part of me might be, but this part definitely is not. So locality, particularity, resistance, containment, boundary, all of these are aspects of the physical realm, and they provide useful constraints or useful characteristics for the soul. And there are risks involved in these characteristics. Now, one of the challenges to incarnation is, how do we take the soul, and we might picture the soul as free range through the entire landscape around here, how to take it and get it into this one single room, how to particularize this relatively multidimensional vast consciousness, how to get the soul into the physical world, the earthly world, because there's a distinct energy differential between where the soul is and where we are here. How to cross that? How to cross that bridge? And without making too much of a mystery about it, the way, as I understand it, that this has been accomplished is by the creation of a structure that is able to hold both ends. And I sort of think of it as a bridge. And it has one end in one side of the river and one end in the other side of the river. So in a sense, it doesn't belong to either side completely, but it has characteristics that anchor it in both. But those characteristics are very different on either side. So the bridge has to be able to, you know, adapt to the conditions on one side of the river and adapt to conditions on the other. And that bridge is the energetic structure that I think of as the personality. That the personality, while it can be defined in a number of ways, looked at through this particular incarnational lens, through this particular energy lens, it is the bridge that enables the the soul to engage with and become part of the incarnate world, the physical world. And this puts this energy structure in a peculiar place, because it has to have characteristics that both sides can relate to, so to speak. But what that means is that neither side will be fully comfortable with it until a kind of integration takes place. So there will be aspects of the soul, aspects of the personality that are definitely designed to engage with resistance and boundary, to embody resistance and boundary and particularization and all those characteristics that make us part of the physical realm. But at the same time, there are parts of it that can engage with this freer domain, this larger consciousness that, if I go all the way into it, I find myself in contact with my higher consciousness, or with the soul consciousness. And historically, I believe, looking over the millennia, being able to make this bridge coherent, being able to work the bridge, so to speak, so that it serves both sides, has been something of a challenge. And there's that in the soul which doesn't entirely feel at home in the kind of restricted conditions that this domain offers. And there's part in this domain that doesn't feel entirely at home in the vast aspects that the soul offers. And the personality gets caught in the middle, so to speak. Thinking now of it again as an energy structure. Now, when we think of our personalities, we don't think of it as an energy structure. We think of it as ourselves. We think of our personality as an expression of who we are. The word itself means the mask that we show the world. So that right there, there's a kind of implication, at least classically there was an implication, that the personality is constructed to present a certain face to the world, and there's another reality behind it. I think now, when we think about the personality, we think of the fullness of our incarnate identity. This is who I am. I'm David Spangler, and that's my personality is being David. Julie's personality is being Julie, and so on. So I don't necessarily think right off the bat, my personality is actually an energy structure, an energetic structure that's designed to do certain things. But if I can begin to see it in that way, then it frees me. It starts to free me from the restrictions that I might find, or the challenges I might find in this particular structure. So let's use the blackboard here a bit. So here's the world, and that's everything. Trees, rocks, mountains, rivers, mosquitoes, other people. It's just everything that's outside of us in our environment. And here we are. And here, behind all this, is the soul. So this is trying to connect with this in a meaningful way. It's needing to, and we'll get in more to what I mean by that in a moment, but this is trying to engage with the phenomena that's found here. And in order to do so, it creates for itself this physical body. That puts us that puts us on the stage. But we all know there's a good deal more to the world than just its physical side. So we want to be able to, so how do I want to say, I didn't say that right. If my physical body, if all I have is a physical body, it can be inert. I mean, there are people who are in comas, they've got perfectly good functioning physical bodies, but there's no engagement going on with the world. So here is an energy structure, and it is designed to be able to take in thought, feelings, and now I'm thinking of these as subtle energies. So this is subtle energy thought and subtle energy feeling. It's designed to take in all this information that comes from the world and make it available ultimately to the soul, but certainly to the consciousness that exists in the physical body. So this thing is the energy structure of the personality. And it's designed to engage with the subtle energy signature of this domain. So here's the thing. When I talk with subtle beings, like when I would work with John, they have to make an effort to see me. They have to make an effort to see any of us as far as that goes. It's not like they're sitting on a cloud and looking and they can see everything we're doing. We are as insubstantial to them as they are to us. And so one can picture, a Carl Sagan on the other side saying, oh, there's no such thing as a physical world. It doesn't exist because I can't see it. I'm sure that Mr. Sagan is not saying that at this point. But the point is that these beings are at a different energetic frequency from us, which interpenetrates the world we're in exactly the same way that this room is filled with radio waves and microwaves and television broadcast, and none of us are picking up on those. If we wanted to do so, we'd need a radio or a television set that's designed to bring those frequencies into manifestation for us. But otherwise, they're invisible, and there's lots of electromagnetic radiation that's perfectly invisible to us, and we never know it's there, unless in some way we can have some tool that adjusts the frequency of our awareness to be able to see them. So that's what happens here. A subtle being has to adjust its frequency to come close into this world. And some cannot get very close into this world, so that means the human individual has to adjust his or her frequency to meet them halfway. So it's like Freya can only come down to the first landing on the stairs. If I want to talk to her, I have to go up the stairs a bit to that first landing, and then we can talk. So the personality as an energy structure is like a tool that, it's like a television or radio, it is sensitive to and able to receive and able to hold the particular frequency of manifestation, of substance, that the physical and emotional and mental worlds, what I call the incarnate realm, are made up of. And otherwise, these two are like ships passing in the night. They don't actually perceive each other. And there's no reason for the soul to be aware of the physical realm unless there's something that helps it to do that. It doesn't have to be a personality structure. There can be other things. But in an incarnational context, this is the structure that is designed to receive and hold material coming in from the world. So the challenge is that it does not do so with 100% efficiency. part of the challenge is the difference between the difference of, let's just call it, the rate of holding, I'm sorry if this is sounding all very engineeringly like and technical, but or we could also call it the rate of letting go. So here, this has a very high letting go quotient. What I say is the inner worlds are very fluid and can shift easily and quickly from one mode, one state of being to another. It's not that there's no permanency here or structure, there is, but by our standards, it's a good deal more fluid. But here, this world is such that it does not let go easily. There's a resistance to change, and thank God. Otherwise, we could not depend on this chair you're sitting in, or the sofa you're sitting in, or that table, to stay a sofa or chair or table. There's a high quotient of, I'm not letting go. But that means that that not letting go becomes part of the necessary energy structure that makes up, or the becomes part of the characteristic that makes up this energy structure I'm calling a personality. Because it has to be able to hold in ways that the soul does not. It has to be able to hold in a way that's comparable to the world in which it's functioning and of which it is a part. But the consequence of that is that residue can build up. Residue builds up that we don't let go of easily. So think for a moment of memory. An event happens. I experience that event on many levels. I experience it physically, I experience it emotionally, I experience it mentally, I may experience it vibrationally at a higher level. And now, it might be something that's fairly trivial. Mentally, I let it go. It doesn't really remain as a memory. Emotionally, I've let it go. But there might be something about it that the body holds on to, because the body doesn't let go quite as fast as my mind does. So let's say you say something to me that that hurts my feelings. And I think, so then I react, tighten up, adrenaline starts flowing. I feel whatever I feel physically, ashamed or angry or irritated or what have you. Then I think, oh, Jeremy didn't mean to hurt my feelings. Besides, I'm a spiritual person. I can rise above this. So I let it go. And in fact, I can let it go. I can let the mental aspect of it go, and I can let the feelings go. But there's still hormonal stuff going on in my body. There's still physical reaction. And if that becomes part of the body's muscle memory, or it's just its hormonal memory, then it's molecular memory, then in a sense I'm carrying the residue of that insult around with me, even though mentally I've let it go. There hasn't been complete 100% efficiency in letting go. And it might be something, well, so for example, in my case, last year I went through several surgeries, and actually I've gone through these surgeries, I should go back further, I've been going through surgeries for 10 years now for bladder cancer. And you know, when I first started doing it, they put you out, I'm out. It's a simple kind of surgery. They go up, they scrape the tumors out of the bladder, and it doesn't take very long. It's almost an outpatient situation unless there's complications. Usually I can go home the same day as the surgery. So I go home, there's a bit of, pain, bleeding, whatnot, but it clears up. And one day I'm sitting on the sofa and I suddenly am feeling anxious. And I have no idea where this anxiety is coming from. So I go into it and I'm tracking it down, and I realize I suddenly have this vivid experience of being on the operating table. And I said to my body, hey, wait a minute. We were under anesthesia. And my body says, you were under anesthesia. I was experiencing everything that was going on. Come on, wait a minute here, guy. You didn't feel anything, meaning my conscious mind, but the body mind was aware of the pain, the invasive technique, the whole thing. This really became evident last year with some considerably more invasive surgery. And it has taken a good year to work all that out of my physical system. In fact, even now, occasionally, very much rarer, but occasionally I'll suddenly get this sense of anxiety in my body, and I think, oh, okay, I know where this is coming from, because now I know I've been working with it, and I can track it back to the hospital experiences and the surgery. So here's a case where some part of me is letting go at a much slower rate than other parts of me. And if this residue builds up, as we'll see in a minute, that can become a kind of secondary perspective on the world. And I think when we say, oh, the personality is foe, it has this these negative aspects of ourselves or things that we don't like or reactions and so on. Part of what we're talking about is the existence of this ongoing residue that hasn't been fully transmuted or reclaimed. And in fact, you know, there's nothing new about this thought because that's basically what a great deal of psychotherapy deals with, is how to get back into and clear out that memories. But I'm just looking at it from an energetic standpoint and saying that in the subtle energy bodies, there are energetic residues that continue to exist as well. And, of course, in the physical body, which is one reason why in the past, I don't know, 20 years maybe, 15 years, somatic therapy and psychology has really been advancing. And it, I think for many psychotherapists, it's seen as the cutting edge, the way to go, because you need to deal with the body, not through drugs, but through body therapy, as well as trying to deal with the non-physical memories.